Right. So I hope this goes well. I think Bruce, Lars, and I are the only lecturers from the first CIDR here. Is that correct? It shows something about our age, yes. But I have to tell you, the first CIDR was not nearly as low-key as this one. And I know you might not think this one is low-key, but Bruce, Lars, and I each gave 4 or 5 lectures at the time. And I can tell you, I've never worked as hard as those 2 weeks, except for grad school. So things have improved dramatically since then. Okay, so I hope to add to the really excellent set of lectures that we've had so far. We are reprising the theme of the first CIDR in terms of the origin, detection, mixing, preservation, destruction of heterogeneity, and heterogeneity being defined at the time that we did it at the first CIDR in terms of seismic heterogeneity, what was the origin of the seismic heterogeneity observed, and how did it relate to the geochemical side. I also want to add, for those of you that are young in the audience, that you know, CIDR is a fantastic opportunity, not just for you to network new collaborations, but for us as well. So I can tell you that almost everything I'm going to show you today came out of that first CIDR, right? Because I started a collaboration with Stan Hart, you know, he was part of a big proposal that we did on experimental fluid dynamics of plumes and all the development that came from that. And so, you know, it's really great. And then someone mentioned, I forget who, the first day, Sujoy, that you know, a paper on viscosity structure that also came out of CIDR. I gave a talk saying that, you know, the viscosity structure of the mantle was still uncertain. And Ved and Max, whom you'll hear next week, said, oh, let's revisit that with, you know, some cool new statistical techniques. So I think it's been great. I've gotten postdocs out of this. And so I hope you take full advantage of it. Okay, right. So there's a point to showing this, and you'll see it in a minute. Okay, I've done something else, and thanks to Sana for uploading them. I want you to point you to a couple of lectures on mixing, which I think will be better than mine. and because they're CIDR, there's the video, there's the slides, and I've borrowed liberally from both of them. And that's Michael Manga's 2012 lecture, and I think Luis Kellogg's 2014 lecture. I can't remember exactly the year. But they have some of the fundamentals of mixing. So today, I'm going to try to give a little bit of that, but I also want to try to talk to you about some more recent techniques, which we'll use in the tutorial that we'll show you in a minute. Well, I'll show you in a minute. We'll show you next week. And these are techniques that come from the fluid dynamics community that have to do with visualizing flows and understanding the organization of flows, but are critical to understanding entrainment and mixing. Okay. So there are two papers. One is, you know, more accessible. It was in Physics Today, Peacock and Haller. George Haller is, you know, one of the gods of Lagrangian coherent structures, or calculating them. Okay, and then there is the recent Annual Reviews of Fluid Mechanics paper, which, you know, it's more involved, but, you know, for those of you who are interested, I think will be a really good technique. And then, you know, one of the pioneers of mixing and using some of the techniques we'll talk about today is Shadden at Berkeley, and he has a really good web tutorial. So you look into that. Now, what do we talk about when we talk about mixing? Well, I think, you know, one of the things that we have to understand, and I think Sujoy talked about this in his lecture, is that when you talk about heterogeneity and when you try to sense heterogeneity, you need to also, you know, not just use the proper sort of isotopic systems or whatever, but you need to understand something about the genesis, the genetic process of that heterogeneity. So what kind of creation do you have? Is it primordial, perhaps from the magma ocean, and we heard something about that yesterday, or from convective tectonic processes, okay? The other thing, sort of trying to understand the origin of seismic heterogeneity and what we see in terms of the geochemistry, is, you know, is there a connection? Is there a physical connection between the reservoirs? And what are the length scales and what controls the length scales? Okay? So not surprisingly, of course, you're going to argue that the most important thing there is mantle dynamics, because mantle dynamics is going to control the length scale of that heterogeneity, right? It also is going to control its preservation, its destruction, the time scales of survival, or not. But it's also, I'm going to argue, and this is in Michael's lecture as well, it also contributes to the origin. And we'll see that in a minute. So before I do that, there are some things that I'd like to make clear, mostly to the students. Is what do we see seismically and geochemically are not necessarily the same things. And so let's make clear, and Lars presumably will talk about this, and Kanani sort of mentioned some things too. Seismically detectable heterogeneity means that you have to impact the elastic constants that give rise to the wave speeds. And so normally that will be due through major element chemistry, right? Because it has to affect the lattice enough to do that. Okay, minor elements, you know, possibly, you know, if you think about water effects and attenuation, if you think about, you know, that some minor or even trace elements might have some impact on the seismic velocities, possibly, right? But, you know, usually isotopes, trace, you know, they're not going to have a seismically detectable signal, right? So the location of the heterogeneity in terms of geochemistry will depend on its genesis, but it will depend on us interpreting it in a certain way, right? Because it will also depend on what source region you're sampling, how much entrained material there is, and then once you bring that material up, what processes you have in the melting region, and besides that, how you sample it, right? Because just like earthquakes, we do not have a, you know, uniform distribution of volcanoes. Okay, so let's keep those things in mind, and let's look at the origin of heterogeneity, right? So I think this nice cartoon from LaBrosse et al., it's an AGU monograph, you know, sort of illustrates nicely the types of heterogeneity we can talk about, and we talk about a lot today, both in terms of seismics and perhaps in terms of geochemistry. So for one, we have, you know, two genetic possibilities, primordial perhaps. So these are, you know, these regions here, you know, we can identify them with LSVPs. Are they remnants of the magma ocean, perhaps the ULVZs? You know, so they have an origin that traces back to maybe that impact, those impacts that form the moon that Mickey was talking about yesterday and Sarah will talk about on Monday, okay? But there is another type of heterogeneity, right, which is related to the convective process, which I'll mention in a minute. So if you have, you know, something that is a remnant of the magma ocean, where you might have, you know, regions that are chemically distinct because of whatever process, perhaps not efficient mixing, like Sarah mentioned, you know, because perhaps in a magma ocean, because of rotation, you might not get efficient mixing. You know, it's a question, okay? You know, LaBrosse did this nice sort of paper, LaBrosse and others, where they also try to identify some geochemical signals that might be related to those basal magma oceans that come from crystallizing the magma ocean from the middle rather than the top or the bottom. Okay, so, and Sujoy mentioned this, is it the reservoir for 142 neodymium anomalies, okay? And then it's seismically related to something, so it gives you a location, it gives you a physical reservoir, it gives you a way of identifying it. Okay, there's something else in that picture, right, in terms of heterogeneity that is at small scales, right, which are all these little bits right here. So for the non-lecturers in the audience, what do these represent? The crust, what crust? The oceanic crust, right? So, you know, and here come the element of where the convective process, first of all, let's get something clear, convection and plate tectonics are one and the same thing, right? You know, it was obvious from Bruce's lecture, you can identify the top boundary layer of the convecting system as the plate, right? Okay, but we have this process in the mantle, right, where you melt, you know, in ridge regions, right, to form mid-ocean ridge basalts that forms a crust that has a distinct composition, and that crust, right, has a composition that something will happen to it once it gets into the mantle. So the convective process continuously generates chemical heterogeneity, and because of the subduction, it continuously destroys it as well, right? So the convective process is a machine to continuously generate thermal and compositional heterogeneity, right? And so, you know, this is what I have illustrated here. And as a result, you know, you have, you know, the illustrated in, you know, so the slabs going down, you know, perhaps some fluids going on, so you're continuously changing the mantle. So you're continuously generating the heterogeneity, so you can't talk about necessarily one given timescale. So what happens to that oceanic crust, and why would it look like, you know, little bits coming off of it? Okay, so basalt, right, and Bruce showed this, right? So the melting process, you form the oceanic crust, and then the residue behind, and Esteban talked about this, the residuum, you know, is something else, right? And those two things have different densities, right? So that means that in the oceanic lithosphere, you'll have a very thin crust with, you know, low density, and then you have a residuum that has a higher density, to which you'll accrete something for thermally, right, that has maybe a slightly different density as well. Now, the basalt, however, undergoes a phase transformation to high pressure. We heard about phase transformations before, and it becomes eclogite, right? And eclogite has a really, really high density, right? So all of a sudden, you have a driving force for separating the oceanic crust from the complement of residuum that is next to it. So you have basalt and you have Hartzburgite. And this process of delamination is what gives rise to all these little bits that you might see in here if it happens in the mantle, right? And what that means is that perhaps the composition of the mantle is not, you know, some equilibrium assemblage of some rock, some lherzolite, and so on, but it actually is a mechanical mixture of the basalt and, you know, the residuum, okay? Now, if that basalt stays dense all the way down, it actually will accumulate at the bottom, right? So you'll have ancient graveyards, perhaps, of basalt, of graveyards of ancient basalt, which might have a different composition, formed at different potential temperatures. And now you have a different explanation for LLSVPs, or LLVPs, as Sana called them. So this is important, right? Because the seismic signal and the survival and the entrainment of that heterogeneity depends on that genetic processing which you're forming, as thus understanding, you know, what's happening in the mantle. Okay, in fact, you can see that the seismic signals are different. Presumably Lars will touch on this a little bit more, right? And it is that, you know, if you have an equilibrium assemblage, right, of something that's like a lherzolite or pyrolite, right? This is the phase proportions, and so what you see here, they're the different phases, sort of the olivine system and the garnet-perxene system. This is depth, this is shear wave velocity here, and if you have the equivalent composition, bulk composition, but a mechanical mixture of Hartzburgite and basalt, you actually can see from the blue line that they have different velocities, right? So they have a different signal. Okay? And the basalt, of course, will have an entirely different signal, an entire set of phase proportions. If the mantle is made of this mechanical mixture, right, and of all these little bits, right, the process of mantle convection will actually change the length scale of these bits as we go along, right? It will move them around, it will stretch them and fold them, and that will sort of impact the process of mixing. And ideas like this is what led Allegre and Hoffman, right, you know, recycled oceanic crust and plumes and so on, to say that the mantle was a marble cake, right? I chose this picture because of the red and green, so, of the eclogite, okay? And then you have to ask yourselves, how long do these survive, right? And I think, again, Lars, oh, sorry, so just say your name, otherwise, just say, Carolina, stop. Done.
Sorry. If you go to the one slide before. So yesterday we learned that the oceanic basalt, I mean mid-oceanic rich basalt, they probably have gone through some changes in chemical composition. So through time, yes, because of the secular cooling, which means that the basalt composition, if you actually think of time dependence, is not fixed composition, then the mineralogy wouldn't be fixed into one composition, one model, which probably means that there might be variety of or gradual sort of like range of different mineralogy that can be mixed into that model. So that red may be not entirely all red. Maybe it changes from orange to red slowly with time.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And that's why I refer to this graveyard of basalt as maybe graveyard of ancient basalt. Now, Bruce mentioned something about, I think it was Bruce, if you increase, and maybe Esteban also, that if you increase the potential temperature, you'll produce more crust. And, you know, so you'll have a package of oceanic lithosphere that's maybe perhaps more buoyant and that affects plate tectonics and so on. But one thing to consider is that, in fact, at higher potential temperatures and deeper depths, you're actually melting in the presence of different mineralogy. Yeah? So the composition of that crust is not necessarily the same either as you go back in time. Right? So perhaps this is something that Paul Azema said at a CIDR several years ago. He said, you know, maybe the complement has the exact same buoyancy, just because the crust has a different composition. Now, that computation has to be made. I haven't done it, but it's an interesting thing to ponder. Other questions? So just, you know, I get carried away and I don't actually look at the audience, so I don't know who's asking questions, so just say something. Okay. Right. So the question is then whether there is survival or not, right? You know, will these survive, you know, over the process of stretching and so on in the mantle? And that's what this is meant to illustrate. This is time, this is distance, so, you know, the thickness, right, of that, you know, of that heterogeneity. And these are the effects, and we'll touch upon this again later, these are the effects of chemical diffusion, right? And, you know, so this is a 7-kilometer crust here. Yeah, 7-kilometer crust here. And then, you know, as you stretch it and fold it, you can increase, you know, sort of the region in which, you know, diffusion will be more effective. Anyway, the bottom line is that it's actually really, really hard to homogenize, you know, the heterogeneity. And I think, you know, Lars will touch upon this. But the other thing that's interesting, given sort of Nick's sort of, oh, yeah. Well, I can hear you.
when you're stretching something, it's going to get thinner in one dimension and longer in the other. Is this an average length scale or?
Yeah, well, so this is, you know, sort of in this particular case is an average length scale of some stretching with given exponential stretching in one direction. But in general, right, it's the surface area that increases and that will increase the diffusion. So even if it gets longer in one direction, you're still increasing the surface area, so that'd be okay. But I was just going to mention your name, because if you have a mechanical mixture, right, these are scatterers, right? So if the mantle is, you know, sort of made of a mechanical mixture because of this convective genetic process, right, then you should have scattering, right? How much will depend on, the, you know, I suppose the length scale of the scatterers, but also the relative VPVS ratios of the constituent materials, right? Okay, now, so that's one type of heterogeneity at one end, one that has potential seismic signals, clear perhaps locations in terms of reservoirs, but the perhaps more interesting in terms of thermal evolution of the Earth or geochemical evolution of the Earth, and certainly in terms of the samples that we have, is the geochemical signals that come from isotopes, right? And we heard that from Sujoy. And you've seen this before, this the isotopic array in epsilon neodymium and strontium ratios, and these different identified regions. Okay, and one of the things that Sujoy said that was really important, right, is that extricating meaning from this requires a lot of thought, right? Because, you know, whether this is something that is the mixture of that and that, for example, requires knowing the source regions, the amount of entrainment, the processes of the melting region, and what kind of sampling you might have. And all that requires understanding what the mantle does to the material as it flows. And therefore, it requires understanding dynamical mixing. Okay, so again, some more reading material. Oh, sorry, Dominic, go ahead.
Comment. I'll address that tomorrow. You can generate any of these trends in the previous diagram by just mixing the N members, and you can calculate the relative proportion without knowing anything else.
Okay.
And I'll, that's one of the things you guys will calculate on Monday. Just to break a few myths, it's not as complicated as some of us might make it sound.
Okay, well, it might not be, but to relate it to the dynamical processes is, right? And I think, you know, to get a complete picture then of what the dynamics are doing and how that is affecting the heterogeneity, I think that is interesting, right? Okay, so here is the bulk of the talk. Here is going to be the hard part. And I want to say something else. I started out as a geologist, right? So my math and physics were shaky and probably still are. And so feel free to interrupt and correct me. I will not be offended. I promise you, I have tenure. I don't care. So I probably shouldn't say that. Okay, but so here's my reading material, but also really important, right? There's a professor at Northwestern called Julio Otino, and he was instrumental in talking about, you know, in sort of formulating, you know, how we understand transport and mixing, right, in chaotic processes. And one of the things he says in this great Annual Reviews of Fluid Mechanics paper that he wrote, this is fantastic, by the way, the Annual Reviews of Fluid Mechanics, you should know that. Is that virtually everyone agrees that mixing is complicated. So, mixing is hard, right? And this is a perfect illustration of why it's hard. So here is, some fluid, and you've got a little green ball here and a little red ball, and then, you know, you shear the system or, you know, you move the walls, you know, in some periodic way or whatever, and look at this. The green hasn't mixed, right? The green has barely stretched. And even within the really stretched and what you call mixed areas, right, there are plenty of islands that are unmixed, right? And so this is not dissimilar from our planet or our cartoon pictures where, you know, you might have regions that are really well mixed and regions that are not well mixed, okay? So in this part, you know, I just want to try and make, you know, a few points about, I wouldn't call them fundamentals of mixing necessarily, but about the things we need to worry about, especially in the context of geochemical signals. And the things we need to worry about are defining, right, what is stirring, right, the stretching and folding and moving it around, what is mixing itself, okay, and entrainment. And why does that matter? That matters for extricating the information of that array. So take, for example, right, you know, a picture like this, where you have these might be the LLVPs, okay, and there might be plumes that are coming off the edge and might be sampling. Some of it might be picking up stuff from here, and one limb might be picking up stuff from the LLVP, okay? So how do you find that source region, okay? How do you define the amount of entrainment? How much is it coming from, you know, the very source or the very edge? And how is it interacting inside? So here's one illustration. This is from an experiment in my lab, okay? And this is, you know, you put a heater and you heat fluid. And then, you know, you do sort of a passive dye. Basically, just numerically, you advect tracers, okay? And you color code the tracers according to where they come from. Okay, and so in this very simple picture, right, you know, you could define a source, but how, right? Is the source defined by the thermal halo? And how do you define the thermal halo, right? At some point, you know, you're going to go into the ambient. Is it 1%, you know, the 1% contour of the total temperature anomaly? Is it defined by some buoyancy? All these things sort of gradually go from one into the other. So what I'd like to do is to try and show you some of the things that can be done in fluid dynamics to get more objective measures of source entrainment, stirring, and mixing. So let's start with some terminology, right? Stirring and mixing, what's the difference? In principle, mixing and the way that it's done in certainly in fluid dynamical experiments, mixing implies molecular diffusion, right? And mixing implies that there's complete chemical homogenization. And this is how, you know, in industrial applications, food, things like that, you know, that's what they worry about, right? So it really is controlled by the length scales, like we were talking about before, and it's controlled by diffusion, and therefore the chemical diffusivity of the material. Okay, stirring, and really, so what's going on in the mantle, except maybe melting regions, and except for very short length scale, is stirring, right? This is mechanical mixture of two things. And so it's stretching and folding of material surfaces that allow you to reduce length scales. Okay, but as you saw before, some of that reduction of length scales isn't really good enough to necessarily give you sort of chemical homogenization. Okay, so there are two extremes, sort of turbulent mixing and laminar mixing, right? What defines, what separates the turbulent regime from the laminar regime is the Reynolds number, one of the dimensionless numbers that Bruce talked about, right? And so laminar flows are a Reynolds number of one and less, and turbulent is considerably bigger than one, okay? And so you think of turbulent systems like the atmosphere, like the core. Is the core turbulent? Yeah, I suppose it is. You know, as very effective mixers. But that isn't necessarily true, as you saw in the picture from Atino, okay? So, but you can also generate sort of chaotic mixing, as you saw again from the picture before, that in viscous flows, like the mantle, right, by simply making it time dependent, which is one of the great great things that we have out there. Now, so let's look at diffusion, right? So the governing equation of diffusion, so I didn't use T here because this could be a chemical, yeah.
I have a question going back to chaotic mixing. Mm-hmm. I asked that question yesterday, but don't you, can you produce chaotic mixing also just by just having compositional difference and that's it?
For the Rayleigh numbers of the mantle, I don't think so. And it will depend on the flow structure. For very viscous materials, I think you need some time dependence of the flow. And if you are effectively separating into very simple flow patterns, that will be hard to actually have chaotic mixing. So I think composition is not enough. I think you need a time dependence. Does the composition add a time dependence? Yes, for different regions. So that's.
What about in a magma ocean?
Well, a magma ocean, Sarah, Bruce, should be turbulent, right? It has much, much higher Rayleigh numbers and much, much higher Reynolds numbers. Bruce.
Can you just make a quick comment?
Yeah.
For mantle viscosities, it's going to be really hard to separate components once they get small, right? So if you have a package that has chemical heterogeneity at sort of meters, hundreds of meters, kilometer scales even, that's not going to separate. That's going to act as a single parcel of fluid, whereas in a magma ocean, very small things will be able to separate. And
yeah.
You can imagine quite different process in that
yeah.
context.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, Zach. Can you wait for the...
I was just hoping you could explain in a little bit more detail what do you mean by time-dependent flows? What's time-dependent there, the Reynolds number or the viscosity?
No. There are steady flows that have the same pattern all the time, right? Time-dependent flows change that pattern. So, for example, in the mantle convecting system, you know, the pattern won't be the same at any given time. There'll be things coming up and there'll be things going down. And so we think now that it's time-dependent enough that you can, basically generate sort of chaotic mixing. So another time-dependent flow is suppose you have a fluid, and I'll show an example of this in a minute, and then you pulse a wall, right? So even though the Rayleigh number or the conditions are such that you get a steady flow, if you move the wall, right, up and down, or at the top, for example, you generate a time-dependent flow because you're generating a shearing of the system. So, but mantle convection is very time dependent, right? And you can see that in the pulsing of plate velocities that changes with time.
How important is the number of dimensions in your model, like 2D versus 3D sphere?
Vary, right? So in a 2D model of steady flow, you can't generate certain mixing characteristics. It's enough to go to 3D to break that, or in the 2D, adding a time dependence, like moving the wall. So yeah, dimensionality becomes important.
The magma ocean issues are not just the Reynolds number, because if it's spinning fast enough that there's columnar convection, then your dominant length scales are completely different. And then in terms of what are you tracking, whether you're tracking dissolved gas versus some other chemical signature, and how those signatures interact and are erased or implanted, the time scales for homogenization will be different.
Absolutely, and that's a really good point. I was not going to talk about any rotational flows or any turbulent flows, but one of the things that happened, first, you know, organizing in columnar convection, for example, but one of the things that happens, even, you know, so you insert a rod and you shear, you rotate, actually, one of the things that can happen to the system, even without actual fluids, I mean, like liquids, is that the, you know, if you look at the spectrum of decay of the mixing, you go from filaments to bubbles, and all of a sudden, the mixing efficiency increases dramatically as it goes from filament to bubbles, dramatically. And that's just from the rotation rates and being able to separate into this sort of different areas. And so there are some really good mathematical theories for that, which I wasn't going to touch.
What makes chaotic mixing special in terms of those three equations? Like, what's the component you add in once it becomes chaotic?
So the chaotic mixing has very specific characteristic. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit without necessarily showing the equation. But first, it stretches and folds. Then it has the orbits of the particles, you know, can both come back to the same point and join different equilibrium points and go to different points. So that's really, and then the stretching and folding can come back on itself. And what it does, it increases the efficiency of mixing dramatically. So if you were to look at the spectrum of that, it's an exponential decay, although it turns out that at least in experiments, you almost never reach that. And it's not clear why.
So Caroline,
is this something like a Nolan's equation you're talking about, like a deterministic chaotic equation?
I'm not sure I understand.
Because there is a chaotic theory, like, yes. there's a deterministic. Something like that.
Yeah, right? So the analysis is all from that. The analysis is all from equivalent to that, the, you know, sort of casting the equations, the dynamical system equations, and thinking of chaos and thinking of attractors and thinking of repelling. Yes. So that's it's the analysis of the mixing in those terms is exactly that. Yes. Yeah, sorry for not understanding.
So, Caroline, I'm returning maybe to the chaotic mixing and the time dependence. Would it be fair then to say that on a planet with plate tectonics like the Earth, where you have plate boundaries moving over time, length scale of moving and things, then you would have more chaotic mixing than in a one-plate planet and stagnant plane?
So that's really interesting, and I wasn't going to touch that, but Michael does in his lecture. Right, and actually, he doesn't even talk about the changes in the plate motion. Well, a little bit. So, but Peter Van Kecken and Shi Ji Zhang took my models of plate motion history, imposed them on a convecting system, and then looked at the trajectories of the particles, and they did the Poincaré maps and so on. And what happens is that, you know, what gives you a lot of efficient mixing is the toroidal part. That's the shear associated with transforms, okay? But the minute you move the plate boundaries around, you can isolate regions. So you can basically take regions and make them sort of isolated from the mixing system just because you've moved one plate to another. You can also do the opposite, for example, right? But it's not a given that moving, right, the walls, and as you saw in Butina experiments, or the plate motions, leads necessarily to more efficient mixing. It certainly makes it more chaotic, right, because you're moving the walls, you're giving an extra time dependence, but it doesn't necessarily make it more efficient everywhere. Okay. So, I don't think I'm going to get through what I intended, but that's okay. That's okay. Okay. So, here. So, you know, in terms of mixing, right? It's governed by diffusion, right? So, where this is the diffusivity, whether it's thermal or chemical, but the thermal diffusivity for rocks is really small, right? And the chemical diffusivities are also, you know, incredibly small. So, you're not going to do a hell of a lot, right? You might, you know, sort of diffuse by 20 centimeters off your little rock or whatever parcel in a billion years. That's not a lot, right? And so, and you can see that, right, again, in that picture there. That shows it nicely. So what happens then is that convection is really important. Again, by changing the length scales, right, if you add an advective term, right, you end up increasing the gradient of whatever quantity you're trying to look at, the spatial gradients, because you're changing the length scales. And so the process becomes a lot faster. But again, in the mantle, it might not be enough. So if we look at a picture of what this might look like, right? So this is your starting point. You stretch and fold and advect. This is a little bit of molecular diffusion. And then you might stretch and fold enough that you sort of break up into areas and you can stretch and fold enough of those. Now here's an experiment, an actual experiment in corn syrup, not mine, sadly, where you sort of move a rod in a sort of figure eight pattern. So this is very common when you, you know, in cooking or industrial applications of cooking, right? And so you do it enough, right, and you're giving that time dependence of the flow, and you can see, right, the mixing happening, and here this looks really well mixed. But even here, right, unmixed regions, right? And these unmixed regions have definitions, mathematical definitions, and here are mixed regions. Sorry, unmixed regions within the mixed region, right? So that means, right, that that chaotic mixing, or even with that stretching and folding, it's more efficient for certain areas, but it gives you room to have geochemical signatures that are both, you know, sort of well mixed, perhaps, and originating, you know, mid-ocean ridge basalts, and some that are not well mixed at all, which are the sort of isotopic arrays, you know, the isotopes that you see in the ocean island basalt. Okay, yes?
It's just a question.
Yeah.
How is a figure eight efficient mixing? I don't find it chaotic. If I want to mix something, I'm
So it turns out it's because of the, you know, if you think of it as tracer particles, and then Bruce or Sarah or somebody else can add to this, or Laurent, you know, the orbits that you generate in the system, what they do is that the tracers, right, if you think of that as tracers, they generate patterns where things can sort of diverge from it and attract from it, and then that's what you get with this unmixed regions. But it turns out to be that's one of the most efficient sort of rotational ways in which to mix, is to do this figure eight patterns. And it's partly because, talking about the dynamical systems theory, the orbits that it makes end up being efficient ways of mixing, have a higher efficiency of mixing than others. So if you look at how people say generate, you know, when they do mayonnaise, okay, so they might do this, right? But often, you know, people will change the direction, or they might, you know, sort of do that, depending.
Right? Like real chefs do this.
Yeah, real chefs actually do, and you can tell me there are videos on YouTube. You can watch it, and when you stretch toffee, often they, you know, the way they go back and forth, they'll. Okay, Bruce, others, help me out here. I don't think it means random, right? It doesn't mean random. Chaotic doesn't mean random.
That's not chaotic.
It's called chaotic mixing, but yeah, go, Louis. It adds.
The point is, part of this is that you don't need extreme complexity in the input signal in order to get extreme complexity in the output signal. You've got chaotic in terms of the distribution of sizes of little individual reservoirs, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
From what is a completely predictable and regular input.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And the chaos, you know, the term chaotic really comes from that dynamical system analysis, right? Where you have, you can have chaos in a, you know, in certain harmonic oscillators, right?
In part it's also chaotic because you cannot reproduce exactly the same experiment again and again and again. The results are always going to be different.
Okay, so one way of saying that, which I'm going to get to, is that it depends on initial conditions and it can depend on history. And this is the problem for the Earth, right? You have to know what the initial conditions were and you have to know the contingencies of Earth's history, right? And so that is an important point, and this is part of sort of the chaotic system. Now, how do we characterize mixing? And so let's make it a little bit more quantitative. And the reason I'm going to go through this is so that we can get to the point of that this organization or characterization of mixing feels almost like magic. and so we'll see that in a minute. Okay, so Bruce actually mentioned this already, right? Okay, so this is straight from his lecture, right? Which is that the strain rate tensor, right, that sort of the relationship, you know, which is related to the stress by the conservative relation, okay, so that the length of stretching defined like this in lambda, okay, is related to is related to the deformation tensor to the strain rate tensor, okay. So there's a stretching tensor that you can define, and this rate of stretching is a way to characterize mixing, right? So you can think of it as characterizing how far apart particle might go, or might be stretched, or this rod being stretched into this, right? So this is one, and that lambda will come up again. Okay, right. So the lambda is not enough, but you can characterize that the efficiency of that stretching, so the rate of change of that lambda divided by the strain rate tensor, right? Gives you a measure. This is a scalar, and so it gives you a measure of the stretching efficiency, right? Which you define to be sort of less than one. So why is this interesting? This is interesting because it gives you a simple way to characterize, how much mixing you have in a system and how it depends on the flow type. And this is where the questions of thermochemical convection or viscosity contrasts will become important, or layering will become important for the mantle. So for example, for simple shear, the stretching efficiency goes to zero at very large times. For pure shear, it goes to 2/3. Okay? Now, so that's one way to characterize the efficiency. The way we're going to use in a minute is by using Lyapunov exponents. Okay? They're not the same thing, right? These two things, even though this is lambda right here. Okay? Because the strain rate tensor varies in space and time. So at any given point, there'll be more than one sigma, okay? And we're only going to worry about the bigger one, the biggest one. But what does that Lyapunov exponent mean? It means it's the average rate of stretching at any given time t, okay? So think about it this way. You want to characterize how far apart two tracers that were infinitesimally close to each other, how far apart they get in time. You want to have a measure of that, right? Because that is a measure of stretching. That is a measure of deformation. And the finite time Lyapunov exponents allow you to do that. So taking this picture here and what it means, the dependence on the flow type, okay? So this is from Michael's lecture here. Suppose you have a very simple 2D flow in a plane, okay? Define the Vx like this and a Vy like this, right? And so if you have k equals 0, you get simple shear. If you have k equals 1, you get pure shear, and you get hyperbolic flow, okay? And the I read about this a little bit more. They're actually not true hyperbolic points, but that definition apparently has stuck. But you can see it because the orbits around those points look like hyperbole. Okay? But keep this in mind, you know, that's a fixed point of the system. So you can see, you know, so the system is right here, going this way, going that way. These are sort of the velocities. And these are the orbits that tracers might take in that flow, right? And this point right here is a fixed point. Okay, so in a simple 2D flow and in a non-periodic system, that would stay fixed in time. But keep this in mind because this will come back later, okay? Because when the system has time dependence, these lines become material lines of the flow, and they separate flow behavior. And this is, you know, where the concepts of dynamical system come in. So things that are, you know, sort of on one side of these lines behave in one way or take different orbits and or trajectories, and things on another part of that line take other trajectories. And that will define, you know, the mixing regions. Okay. So here again is from Atina and from Michael's lecture. Okay. So here is a that figure 8 pattern. These are the streamlines. You know, so there is a hyperbolic point, which is what we were showing before. And then there are also these regions right here where the orbits are just going around it like that. Okay. And this is what the tracers might look like if you have such a motion. So to going back to a question that was asked before, this is a steady two-dimensional flow, and this doesn't mix all that well in every region. But if you add a time dependence to it, which is this picture that I showed before, if you actually move the wall, you know, you pulse, you say you have a wall here and you can make it go this way or you can make it go that way, and you pulse it back and forth. At a certain period, you actually can get super efficient mixing with some unmixed islands in some regions and not others. Okay? And that again comes back to the mantle and its time dependence. Okay. So the bottom line is that steering can produce complex structures, mixed and unmixed islands, you know, even in viscous fluids, especially if you have time dependence. The chaotic flow depends on being able to stretch, and it's very sensitive to initial conditions, right? Where, you know, those tracers start becomes important, because if they were in that green blob, they'll be different than if they were in the red blob. And that will have something to do with what material a volcano might see at the surface, right? Not just the trajectory that it took, but where it started. And that trajectory will be influenced by where it started. And it will determine the type of flow, you know, it will be determined by the type of flow that you have. So if you have rheological variations, compositional variations, and so on, then, you know, you're going to affect the flow, and therefore you're going to affect the trajectories. So let me show you an example. Okay. So these are the finite time Lyapunov exponent fields. So the tracers, you've seen these before. Okay. For two simulations, these are times, non-dimensional times. Okay. This is actually an isoviscous simulation, and this simulation has high viscosity as you go down. Sorry? The flow is really simple. I think it has three plumes going up and, you know, and then stuff going down. This is very, very simple flow, sort of just as illustration, right? But it turns out that depending on, you know, if you do sort of the FTLE field and if you sort of analyze it, you know, having an increased viscosity doesn't necessarily lead at a certain point in time to less efficient mixing. So preservation of reservoirs isn't necessarily better if you have a higher viscosity mantle. This is, so it's a ratio of, it's the Lyapunov exponent field, that stretching metric, normalized by what it would be, you know, some arbitrary number that is related to a well-mixed region of a certain length scale. And so it's this delta star over delta C. Okay, so there's an example of how the flow structure matters. Okay, now here's another quote from Atina, again from Michael's lecture. Okay, how you characterize the structures, so what stretching metric you choose, what stretching efficiency metric you choose, should depend on the problem that you're looking at and the fluid dynamical process that generated it. Okay, and so it's important, you know, to be careful how you do this. Okay. So I talked about, you know, these two measures of mixing, and they're great, right? And you see these pictures, and you often see in mantle convection people throw tracer fields and, you know, whatever. But what does it mean? And how does it help you understand the flow? Okay. So one of the great developments in fluid dynamics in the last however many years has been, you know, not only the application of dynamical systems theory, but really developing all the mathematical machinery to understand sort of flow, okay? And these are called Lagrangian coherent structures. And you know, the first papers probably date back to the 90s, the really first papers, but you know, sort of the real sort of machinery of today is from 2003, thereabouts, okay? So this is relatively new, okay? And it is new enough that even in industrial applications, isn't used all that much to analyze, you know, what they're doing. Okay, so a Lagrangian coherent structure will be related to those orbits that I showed you before, to the separate points that intersect, to those hyperbolic points and to those elliptic points. And you can think of them as sort of the backbone, as the skeleton of the flow. They're sort of material lines that organize the fluid flow. And so here are two examples. Okay, so this is an ash cloud right here, okay, and the shape that it takes. That linear shape of that ash cloud, the reason it has that shape is because that ash is following a Lagrangian coherent structure, a material line. Now, why, and this is a spill, I think, or, you know, a spill from some, from whatever, some sort of, yeah, so it was the spill of some pollutant. And the shape that it takes also, and the mixing that it does also is determined by these material lines. So what are these material lines, right? These material lines are, you know, a generalization of the concept, you know, of these hyperbolic and elliptic points that you saw. Okay, so someone mentioned dynamical systems theory, and I'm not going to go, you know, in any detail amongst other things because I probably don't understand it as well as I should. Okay, but in that, in sort of understanding sort of the behavior, motion behavior, right? You often have nonlinear equations. The behavior is hard. So instead of looking for a particular solution, you focus on the behavior perhaps of all possible solutions. And you construct a space, a state space, that every point in that space, the coordinates, right, define all possible states of that system. So in classical mechanics, you would do this by plotting momentum versus position, okay? So you can imagine in a harmonic oscillator going like this, or, you know, or there another pendulum that does something like this, that you can plot, there'll be a point that you can plot in this diagram of momentum and position that will define all the possible orbits taken by that. So if you think back to the streamlines that you were showing before with the system 8 and the hyperbolic point and the elliptic points, you know, they would show up in a diagram like this, right? They would show up very much similar to this, okay? Right, so it turns out, right, that if you generalize the concept of your lines or your points and so on, okay, these become surfaces and we call them manifolds, right? And so manifolds is the generalization in multidimensional space of these lines. Now, if you look at sort of, you know, so here's your dynamical system here, the eigenvectors of this matrix here defines, right, the points, the hyperbolic and the elliptic points, okay? And if you think of, you know, this system as, you know, having, you know, sort of these lines right here, these sort of separating lines, they will also define what we call the stable and unstable manifolds. What they are is these are material lines that are either attract the particles or repel the particles, okay? Now before, when we showed this, I told you to pay attention to lines like this. These are called separatrices, okay? And basically they separate flow behavior. Things, basically it, material that is not on these lines cannot cross these lines. And so there'll be a behavior or an orbit, if you wish, you know, on one side of this and another on the other side of this. Now, you might ask, why is this of use or of any interest whatsoever? Is because these lines that organize the flow of that ash cloud or of that pollution stream can be defined exactly like this, by calculating where in the state space are the orbits, where are the separatrices, where are the stable and unstable manifolds. So let me see if I can give you a better flavor for that. So how do you do that, right? So the question is, how do you do that, okay? So if you think about the flow, and you have tracers on the flow, and you measure how far apart these tracers have gone that were together, measured by the finite time Lyapunov exponent, you have a measure of the entire phase map of where these velocities will go. Okay. Now, in a steady field, you'll only have a point, right? But if the flow is periodic, if the flow moves, so you know, you can read that if you want. But take a plume, and this is from the beginning. Take a plume, right? The very center point of that head, right, is actually fixed. So it's actually a hyperbolic point. Okay? Now, if the particles happen to be right on that point, they're not going to move. If they're infinitesimally slightly apart from there, they're going to move very far apart from one side or the other, right? They're going to be stretched along the head of the plume. Okay? And they're going to be stretched along the head of the plume, and the path that that point takes through time, you know, that sort of fixed point at the top of the plume, okay, that is a manifold. Okay? That is a Lagrangian coherent structure. So no material coming from above the plume is going to cross that, right? It's not going to penetrate. Think of it as a club, right? It's a club that has members, but the members, or Hotel California, the members can never escape, right? Well, in the Hotel California, you could come in, but you can never escape, right? But you can also never join the system. And that, because of that, they organize the flow in very clear, coherent structures. So I'm going to skip this, but you do that by basically advecting tracers. So we'll do that. So this is what, you know, you saw this in Sujoy's talk, right? So this is, you know, a calculation in which you have eclogite and pyrolite or, you know, perhaps hartsburgite, and you've seeded the entire system with tracers, and then you've kind of located where all the tracers have gone. But, you know, it's something like this, you know, will tell you, okay, so you accumulated like this, is visually appealing, but there's limited quantitative information in just looking at it, right? How do you define the source region? Which one of these is a plume? Which is the exact edge? Is it the edge of that color scale that you chose? Or is it farther away? But by identifying the material lines, the Lagrangian coherent structures, you can define that objectively and quantitatively. So, for example, right, if I go back to my plume structure right here, I could then define, you know, what is the source region? Because that will be defined uniquely by the Lagrangian coherent structures of my flow, okay? The material that is going to go up in the conduit or that is in the head will be defined by those lines, okay? Instead of some arbitrary measure, right? So here are some experiments for Vatteville and Davai. So how do I define the edge of the plume, right? You know, what's the head? You know, is it this thermal halo? Is it something else? Right? Okay. And you know, here's, for example, some maps of entrainment. Again, these are color-coded by where the material is, right? But, you know, without, you know, just looking at this, you wouldn't know what's the conduit, what's the head, and so on. And that's what the Lagrangian coherent structure lets you do. Okay. So that's exactly what we're going to do. So I'm going to give you an example of how to use it right now. And that's what we're going to do in tutorial 2 for gene dynamics, is to use the finite time Lyapunov exponent field to, we're not going to go quite as far as calculating of the Lagrangian coherent structures, but we'll use it. Okay, so we bother because it gives you a definition of the plume head and the conduit, for example, an objective one, not one that you picked, 1% contour of the, you know, thermal anomaly or something like that. But there's something particularly interesting about the Lagrangian coherent structures. Okay, and here's what's interesting. First, they're real. These material lines are real, as you saw in the pictures of the ash clouds and so on. But also, because there are stable points and there are unstable points, you can use this to define different parts of the material. You can define the stretching, right? You can also define all the material that will ever be entrained. Okay, that seems like magic, but yeah, but it isn't. And they're real. And I'll talk about this in a second. Okay.
So, sort of going back to some of the question I asked before. So do these Lagrangian coherent structures change morphology with time in a time-dependent system?
They shouldn't.
Uh-huh.
They should, the Lagrangian coherent structures should be invariant. It turns out that the exact details of that is still the source of much research. In fact, how to identify the Lagrangian coherent structures is the source of a huge amount of research. Because every time you have time-dependent flows, things happen that you don't anticipate. So what we're using right now, what I'll show you, is using the finite-time Lyapunov exponent field, right? Using the ridges or the maxima, because we said that the maximum eigenvalue is the only important one, and using that maximum to define the Lagrangian coherent structure, and basically growing it in time by advecting either forwards or backwards in time. Okay? The reason for that is that the stable manifold is the point, is the material line in which all the particles will converge to an infinite time, an infinite forward time. Okay? And the unstable manifold is in minus infinite time, where all things will converge to. It's a weird concept, but again, I'm not explaining well. But
and because they're being defined sort of empirically from a time-dependent field, a snapshot of a time-dependent field, it's sort of the, if you were to play that time, that snapshot forward and backwards in time indefinitely, those are the structures you'd find. But a later snapshot would give you slightly different structures.
Right, maybe. So here's the trick. You have to know the entire flow field, precisely for the reason you mentioned, right? And so we can, either experimentally or numerically, we have the entire flow field, right? Given those parameters and those conditions, right? If you don't know necessarily how it will go, or you cannot predict it in some analytic form and so on, then using the ridges of the FTLE field doesn't identify the manifold. The Lagrangian coherent structure is still there, still exists, but it might not be the right, you might not have identified the right one by doing this process of the ridges and growing them forward in time or backwards in time.
Okay. Only for the top system, point there, that's a fixed point, right? That's the point that will never move here and stable, as you said.
Right. So the very top here, right, is fixed. So there'll be a particle right on that point. It won't move, right? And so that's equivalent to the very simple system, that intersection of separatrices. That's a fixed equilibrium point, right? And so in that system, which doesn't vary with time, that would be fixed. In a periodic system with time dependence, you can trace that trajectory if you know the velocity of that point.
So if you only have one point that's fixed in the plume head, how did you relate it to, like, because that's, like,
how do you relate it to
how
what?
Did you relate it to a real system? Like, because you can, of course, argue in the mathematics or fluidynamics that you have one point. That point is, there's no length scale. There's just one point, x equals zero, whatever. How did you relate it to a real?
Well, right, so you still have the flow, right? You still have all the material and all the tracers of the flow, right? And so any material that is infinitesimally a little farther away from that will be stretched along that, right? And will be stretched along that. So this is an experiment. This is a really simple flow. But you can do the same thing in numerical calculation, right? You could use the same techniques to actually identify what is a plume in particular in that system.
Yeah, you may misunderstand what I'm asking. So I'm saying that we know there is one fixed point. That's fine. I mean, but the problem is, as you said, infinitesimal small distance from that fixed point is gonna flow away. It's not going to go back to this fixed point. So what's the geophysical implication for it? We only have one point. That point has
So perhaps I'm not quite understanding what you're saying. You know, you know, it just happens to be in this particular system. But the tracers will, the tracer field. You've mapped the entire flow map with tracers, and you know exactly where those tracers have gone. And if you do sort of the right analysis of the ridge of that DefTLE field, you can then trace where that trajectory will go as a function of time. And that's how you identify this unstable manifold of the head of the plume, for example, right? It's not, you know, it's not like you just have one point and one fixed point. It's just that that one fixed point is very special in the system. Okay, so what I want to show with this is that this is our experiments. This is the unstable manifold. In fact, there are two, right? There's one in the center conduit, and there's one in the head. And what I want to show you is that this is real. These Lagrangian coherent structures are real material lines. What you see on the right, this is a shadow graph. It's not the same plume, but you know, a similar plume with a similar delta T. And what you see in the shadow graph, in the which is, you know, has to do with the index of refraction, what you see is you see the structure for a thermal plume where the unstable manifold is exactly what you would expect. They're real, just like in that ash cloud. They're real. They're real material lines. They separate, you know, blocks of the flow that behave in particular ways. You can see it here too. This is an injection plume, and you can see the unstable manifold right there and how it's going to roll up. This is the three-dimensional shape of the FTLE field, for example. Okay. So in the unstable one, things attract and stretch. In the stable one, it repels nearby fluid elements. Now, I told you that the stable one is how you define how material will be entrained. Okay? Now, entrainment is important for understanding plumes, for understanding how this mixing of the different isotopic arrays that Dominic was talking about, and so on. So here, let me give you an example of how these things matter in terms of interpretation. Okay, so a lot of geochemistry was done with an understanding of plume behavior, especially heads, and the amount of entrainment and stirring based on these experiments by Griffiths and Campbell, where they injected a blob of hot fluid inside a fluid of the same material. Okay, now what if instead you generated a plume not by injecting this blob of fluid of the same material, which has very specific characteristic, but by heating, you know, some part of the bottom? Okay? Now, what I show here, this is the velocity field for a plume that is, you know, just heated from a little heater right here. And this is the, you know, one of the contours, one of the isotherms. Okay? And here, if it's injected for something that we think has equivalent buoyancy. Okay? So here's the temperature, right? Here's the vorticity, sort of the shear that the system is undergoing. So these things look different at equivalent times. They're not the same times because this has a lot more buoyancy, even for the equivalent same Rayleigh number. Now, how is that interesting in the context of stable and unstable manifolds and entrainments and so on? Well, okay, so this is the thermal. This is the injection, okay? This is the unstable manifolds, or the backwards FTLE field, so you can see it all. And this is the forward FTLE field. So the stable manifold that repels things nearby and where you can define the entrained material. Okay? Now, these aren't the same, right? These are not the same. These are very different. Okay? And one way in which they're different is that the material being entrained in the sort of thermal plume is coming from these regions right here and a region right above the head, but it also has a limitation on, you know, sort of at what depth it's picking up the material. While the injection plume, right, has very interesting stable manifolds that sort of protect the head from entrainment in the lower regions. Okay? Now, what are the implications of that? You can see it here. These are the FTLE fields. So this is the material coming. The blues are lines of material coming from the bottom, and red is, the red are lines of material coming from the bottom. Blue is lines of coming radially away from the region. They're very different. The amount of stirring is very different. The ratios of TLE field are very different. So it has very, very different implications. Okay? Now, in terms of an interpretation of geochemistry with that, you would say that plumes in the earth might be more similar to thermal plumes than they are to injection plumes. And if they are injection plumes, right, they would actually pick up material from the upward sort of 1,300 kilometers, while if they are more similar to the thermal plumes, they'd pick up material from only the bottom 600 kilometers. So there'd be big, big differences and implication for the source of the material that you're seeing in the lavas. One last application, and you know, the bottom third of the talk I won't be able to do, okay? And that is, here's another application of this Lagrangian coherent structures and, you know, being able to map these regions of stretching. And it has to do with the folding and stretching that we were talking about before. So, you know, we've mentioned, this has been mentioned before, which is the trends in the Hawaiian volcanoes, the Kea trend and the Loa trend. And people have argued about, you know, what does that mean in terms of the shape of the heterogeneities coming up the conduit of the plume, right? So are these just, you know, these little filaments being, you know, dragged by the conduit, or can you have sort of pancake shapes that, you know, come to the surface? What explain better? So we can use, right, that deformation tensor that we used before, that strain rate tensor, right? This is just the lambda that Bruce defined, right? And this is, you know, the Cauchy grain tensor that I didn't show you for calculating the finite time Lyapunov exponent field. But what we can do is take that information and go beyond a little bit the Lagrangian coherent structures. Okay, because not all the fluid elements, you know, interact with these separatrices, right? But we have information on this, and so we can define a metric for stretching, okay? So by using the sort of strain rate tensor, deformation tensor, in terms of principal stretches of something that starts like this, and then it's sort of flattened out, right? And this is the order of the stretches. S1 is greater than S2 and then S3, and R is a combination of S2 and S3, right? And so basically, a sphere would be a value of 2, a sheet would be a value of 1, and a pencil would be a value of 0. Now, why is this useful? Okay, this is useful because you can take that entire FTLE field and come up with the stretching, you know, the principal stretches, and then color code the regions by the stretching metric. Okay? And so that's exactly what my brilliant PhD student, who was amazing, didn't even have typos in his thesis, but never wrote a paper, did. And you know, he did something more complicated than is shown here. But basically, he came up with this stretching metric, you know, based on actually a paper by Harold Schmeling. And then he color-coded these regions, which are from, you know, come originally from that FTLE field. Okay. And then what you can do, right, is take little sort of spheres or balls of heterogeneity, right, and drop them in different regions of stretching metric, right? You could drop one here, you could drop one here, you could drop one here, and then see how they evolve with time. How much do they get stretched, and as a result, will they homogenize by diffusion or not, okay? And this doesn't look so great, but the movies will look better. It's like basically, here's the yellow one, it becomes a little pencil on the conduit. If you put it right on top of here, it gets spread out in the head. And if it comes from here, which it doesn't seem that far away from the source, it never makes it anywhere. It just stays at the bottom. So if we look at that in a more sort of, you know, color-coded way, and to try to elucidate the hidden structure and what else, these are all sort of different regions of the metric. So for example, this is the head and train phase right here. B is the core of the conduit where the material is going to come, and so on. Right? Okay, so let's watch a movie. So you can see now this material, where it's coming from. And again, you can now talk about entrainment, source, and stretching in a way that does not depend on your definition of the source, right? So you can see that the material here, white material right here, if it's right there, away from that heater, right, ends up in this little part of the head, so it might not end up in the melting region at all, right? So your interpretation of entrainment and so on, you know, might depend on this. The bottom line of this is that, you know, it's impossible to make pancakes in the conduit, so that is out. Perhaps that was obvious. But basically, anything that gets entrained in the conduit becomes a little pencil on the side. Okay, so I'm going to, yeah.
Well, can you go back to the previous?
Yeah. You want to see the movie again?
No.
Okay.
Why are you only on one side? Is that an image of the LLSVP, for instance?
No, it isn't in this particular case, only because of for computational reasons. It's symmetric. Our flow is symmetric. So the other side will be a mirror image of this.
And what triggers the movement in this case?
Oh, it's still our thermal plume. I should have said these are experiments, and there's a little heater that it's 2 centimeters in diameter. And so this is, that's the radius of the heater there, and that's the other radius of the heater there. So we heat it to 80 degrees, which gives you a delta T of about 60, which gives you a plume Rayleigh number of about 10 to the 6.
So what's your numbers on the x-axis?
This is a tank that is 30 centimeters thick, and so this is the bottom of the tank, and this is the top of the tank.
Yeah, no, but the horizontal.
Oh, sorry, x-axis, yes. Okay, that is distance away from the heater.
In
millimeters.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yes, yeah, sorry. Okay, so extricating meaning from this diagram, even though you can reproduce it easily, as Dominic said, but, you know, trying to explain further where the source regions are and where they interact, or some work that Dominic has done, is it picking up entrained material from this side of the LLSVP, for example? Well, some of those pictures, you know, that I showed you before and those diagrams might be very useful for knowing how much it's picking up and so on. So integrating all this together, we're just going to do it in the tutorial, right? In tutorial 2, we are going to take a very simple velocity field like this, okay? We're going to have 9 volcanoes at the top. We are going to calculate the flow. We're going to calculate the FTLE field, okay? And we are going to define a sampling region. This is all done, by the way. It's not like you're going to have to write the code. We're going to define the sampling region, and then we're also defining 2 regions, A and B, perhaps akin to LLSVPs. And then we're defining a metric based on the tracers, how much time the tracers spend near region A, near region B, and how far away they are from region A and region B. And this is all done through the FTLE fields. And with that, you know, we'll define a functional form of how much signal it might absorb from A, the ambient, or B, and then, you know, plot that, different functional forms right here, to see if it matches the signal that you get at the surface. So the idea of this tutorial is to actually use the concepts that, you know, I tried to define today and the ideas of entrainment and sampling to see if you can say something about lavas. And perhaps this is something that we could do in the in the research part of the section. Now, one thing that has been asked and I didn't talk about is what if you have compositional convection, right? What if you have different compositions and they affect the convection because you have different densities, okay? And this is something that we did in tutorial 1. We had a distinct field, right, with a different density, okay? So these are experiments on thermochemical plumes where there is a heater, just like in my experiments that I showed at the bottom, there is a dense fluid. And, you know, you're trying to see, depending on the buoyancy ratio, which René defined, you know, what the behavior of the plume might be. And in this particular case, you know, you're trying to tune so that your thermal and compositional buoyancy match or don't match. And in some cases, the plume collapses on itself. So this will have sort of very interesting FTLE fields, right? Because the tracers will be going up and then will be going down. And what will happen to that? Okay. And let's see if any of you recognize this. What is this? but it is something very specific that you guys saw. Yeah? It is tutorial one, right? This is the FTLE field or the thermochemical model that Rene ran. Okay? So we can also look, we'll probably also look at something like this when it comes to tutorial two when Max is here. Okay, now with the last 5 minutes, I have like 15 slides, which I won't show, I promise, you know. Speaking of thermochemical convection or having compositional differences and so on, the state of the flow, we saw that was important for the stretching and for the efficiency. What if you have layered convection? Sujoy say we no longer talk about layered convection. That's probably true. I'm sure in 20 years we'll start talking about layered convection again. Okay, but there are ways to layer the convection that are not compositional, right? And what are they? And that's what this is a picture of. You know, Diego? A phase transition, right? So at a phase transition, which is a thermodynamic control quantity, not a material flow control quantity, however, you have a big density change and depends on temperature, and therefore you can have part of the system which has a different density than the other, and you can layer the system, and you can do so intermittently, perhaps. Now, what that means is that if you look at, Lars will talk about this, so I'll skip all of that. Okay, if you look at the differences in density, right, versus depth for a plume adiabat or a slab adiabat, right, because of all the phases in the mantle, you know, that density is, or this is d log rho dt, that sort of the derivative of density, the logarithmic derivative of density with respect to temperature, so that sensitivity, you know, it varies a ton, right, and at some point, it becomes negative depending on the type of phase transition you have, right? So that means that slabs and plumes are going to behave differently. It also means that if the temperature of the system changes and the phase assemblage changes, you should have different convection. Okay, so this seems obvious, right? Okay, so here's a phase diagram, pressure and temperature. And the color coding in the background is the thermal expansion of the phases, and these are all the different phases, right? Now, right here, you have negative thermal expansion. Negative thermal expansion should mean that the system layers, okay? Now, at these, you know, maybe we reached these temperatures, maybe we didn't, but it does mean that as you cool the Earth from some initial state and some initial temperature, you're going through different phase transitions. That transition zone not only has different depths, but also is dominated by different phases. And that has an impact on the convection. In fact, just to go all the way here, the impact on the convection, so this is the temperature here. We're going to start at some potential temperature. This is, you know, the equivalent of that negative thermal expansion in the colors that you see here. Blue is regions of negative thermal expansion. And here's the heat flow at the surface. Okay, and so you're going to see the evolution of the geotherm.
I have a question.
Yep.
As far as I know, none of those phases have, when they're in pure composition, they don't behave negative thermal expansion, but I wonder how they can make negative thermal expansion. Are you talking about like partitioning elements into different minerals to make whole assemblage negative?
I think the answer is right. It's sitting right next to you. Lars will talk about that, right? Yes. So yeah, now you have a point, and Lars can talk about that. I mean, there are minerals that do have negative thermal expansion, right?
Yes.
Leucite does. Leucite does, for example, ice.
Yes. Yeah.
They do exist, but the particular minerals that you talked about is
Yeah. Well, these are the total assemblage thermal, you know, negative thermal expansion, so some combination. But Lars can talk about that. But okay, so what you're going to see is the evolution of the geotherm, right? As it, and you know, it starts in this region, and then it's going to kick out of this region, right? And so basically, when it's in this region, it will layer the convection. And when it's away from this region, it will unlayer the convection. And that should result in a big kick of heat flow. as you go from restricted mass transport to mass transport across upper and lower mantle. Okay? And then the questions then on efficiency of mixing will depend on how much time the system spends in this layered state. Right? If the system spends a lot of time in a layered state, in this particular calculation about 80% of the time, then the efficiency of mixing, the preservation of heterogeneity, the time scales of mixing will be very different. Okay? And I think I'll stop there. And I think that's enough for today. Thank you. Yeah, Diego?
Is it? Okay. Yeah. So what I'm wondering is, to calculate your Lagrangian structures, you need to know the flow field.
Yeah.
Right? So is it the instantaneous flow field, or is like the as time goes? Because if you run your system to a steady state, then you have your instantaneous flow field. You can say things about the past, but you don't really know if it is not in a steady state, then
you need to know the full flow field. You need to calculate the flow map. I'm trying to get to that slide. You need to know the full flow field, right? So you need to know it as a function of time, too, because you need to be able to know where the tracers have gone, right? So you can calculate the stretching, and so you do. And so in an experiment and in a simulation, you have that, and you have that for every time step, right? Okay. Now, the final FTLE field will be some integration of all of that.
Please. I guess I have a couple of questions, too. Maybe it's sort of just to help clarify. Mm-hmm.
Please
explain what you already did.
Yeah. But
so maybe a couple things. If you know the strain field, the strain rate field everywhere, I see how you can calculate these Lyapunov exponents. Mm-hmm. How long a time, how finite is the finite time in these calculations? Because you know it's there, I guess you've written it there, it's right, the logarithmic of the stretch divided by some time interval, and you've decided some time interval. That's not obviously...
Yeah, and the time interval does matter, right?
Right.
The length of the time interval. So in the experiments, it's less than a second,
okay.
I think.
So the point, okay.
But in the simulations, I couldn't tell you because I don't remember.
Okay. So, but the point is that if you know the strain rate field everywhere over the time interval that you want to calculate this, it seems possible, at least, that you could calculate that quantity everywhere in the whole field, in the field. And that was what you were showing us with the experiment that we did in the
exactly.
tutorial. But what I'm not as sure about is sort of these coherent structure things. It seems that I'd be able to identify the fixed point is the key issue here. And then you can imagine how you could grow those structures out of these fixed points. But how, or what do you look for, how do you identify those features in sort of a more complicated random field where you can't anticipate where the fixed point is going to be?
So that's a really good point. So this was the sort of insight of George Haller, right? That you don't actually need to know the fixed point, right? Because the fixed point is defined by the saddle or the ridge in the finite time Lyapunov exponent field. So the maxima in the field that you've computed.
Okay. So once you've got that field, you could look at that map and say, okay,
yeah. And so that was his sort of so there were two schools. I think it's the maximum. It's the ridge. So it's the maximum ridge. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's the minimum.
So the point is that from that field, the Lyapunov exponents, you can figure out where the fixed point is.
Yes, you can figure out that specific fixed point, but also you can define the entire surface, right? Because you don't need, there aren't always just a fixed point. They can be a material line or they can be a material surface in 3D, right? And so what identifying that ridge and then advecting it forward in time allows you to compute the shape of that manifold.
Can I ask one more question?
No, please go ahead.
So the Lyapunov exponent is a finite time
one.
It is.
And so now I calculate, say, the same field or scalar quantity for some separate time, how will the fixed points be connected between those two fields? So I do one for sort of one time interval, that t minus t0, and I do it for a second one, and I get a different field of Lyapunov exponents. Do I know how to map the fixed point between those two cases? Would I expect to know where it would be? Or could it be completely a different place?
It could be in a completely different place, and it's the trajectory of that point. So because you know, okay, so you know where the ridge is at any given time, and you know it at the next time, right? And you know basically where that tracer particle was before, you can identify how that ridge is moving. You grow it in time, you integrate it. Basically, you do an integration as a function of time. And that trajectory then, that ridge takes, is what defines your manifold, your Lagrangian coherent structure, right? And in principle, if that was exact, right, that should be invariant, right? That manifold itself should be invariant because stuff shouldn't be able to cross it here and there. But I just read a paper by Haller where he says, you know what, this is no longer true. Not always is the FTLE field identified by these ridges and grown forward or backwards in time really invariant. So it's really not always. Tracing that is not always a Lagrangian coherent structure.
Yeah, I guess I could imagine a thought experiment, right, where I had one flow field, and with low Reynolds number flow, I can do this, right? I have one flow field, and then I stop at some time, I calculate the Lyapunov exponents, figure out where these fixed points. Now I could just completely change the flow. It's just totally different, right? And so it's not obvious that, you know, the fixed points now and where the coherent structure is going to be is going to have any relation. In that context, it's not obvious to me, at least, how you would track it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it isn't, I think it's not obvious to them either. Because especially if the flow is changing because something is getting injected, maybe some,
yeah,
you know, thermochemical.
I think
there are flows that don't have them, right? So that's, you know, one example, perhaps. There are flows in which you certainly cannot calculate in this way and do not have these well-defined Lagrangian coherent structures. Unbelievably, though, a lot of turbulent flows, like vortices and jets, have them, and they're super well-defined. Yeah.
Maybe a follow-up question to that.
Yeah.
But even if the flow field would magically change from one time to the other, the finite time Lyapunov exponent is an integration over time. So even if the velocity is completely changed, the field will not be completely different, like in an infinitesimal amount of time.
Well, that's absolutely right. But if you consider the subsequent finite time after that, it's not obvious that those two fields.
Yeah, that's true.
I think what it means is that you need a huge amount of information, right? Because you need in times that are small enough that the changes in the velocity field are small enough so that such perturbations don't happen.
Yeah, to me, it seems like you had actually, in your definition, you had not just a time, but also a time zero. That T0 is very important. It also relates to what Zach said earlier.
Yeah.
If your flow is time dependent in some way, then, you know, what you're calculating now for those exponents and manifolds will have to change over time. Like, even the picture that you showed, right, one of them was like a volcanic eruption, I think, not had like, you know, probably plume. And said, so, well, it didn't exist 3 months before that picture was taken, so obviously that line, which very nicely delineated the edge of the plume, was irrelevant the previous year.
But, so in the particularities
So it's really event-related, what I'm trying to say. It's very useful for when you have a plume or something, but if you're trying to see...
But it means that the flow in the atmosphere is organized along these material lines, right?
Over that time scale following that event.
Well, you know, given that the atmosphere is turbulent and things, yes, but you know, within the problem that you're trying to define, right? Which is what Ottino was talking about. In our case, you know, very viscous and with time scales defined and so on, you know, then perhaps we don't need to worry.
But for example, it could be that there is some kind of property associated with that event. Like say, now that region, which is brown here, also has a different temperature structures, may actually have changed the flow of the atmosphere. It's not just so.
Okay, so in which case, you know, what the nature of the tracer, matters, right? And therefore, the nature of the heterogeneity. Does the heterogeneity have a rheological component? Does the heterogeneity have a density component? Because the flow will be different. You can't just follow the flow blindly, right? The flow will change because the tracer itself has an effect on the flow, right? And so you have to do that. And you saw that in Renee's field, right? That the FTLE changes depending on the nature of the field. Once you calculate the, you don't actually, well, in the case of active tracers, you do. But you can do this, if there are no active tracers, you can do this as post-processing, right? All you need to know is the flow field, because you'd get the entire flow map from that, but yes.
So you're showing two plumes with different Rayleigh number, and you can sort of track the source region, and can you also
trace about this?
Yeah, for example, can you also trace the deformation in this? Because what I'm thinking is, generally we would assume that if we have a high Rayleigh number, we'll get more mixing. But is this necessarily true? I mean, higher Rayleigh number, you'll get higher velocities, but you also have, because if you have a lower viscosity, you'll get smaller stresses, right? So do you really get more deformation if you have a higher Rayleigh number? I keep thinking about this, and
well, this is like I think it's not dissimilar from the question a little bit about the magma ocean. It's not clear exactly how the mixing efficiency will work. In principle, yes. Now, the differences here are in principle, these are similar Rayleigh numbers, right? But there are plumes that originated in a different way. So in one, you're building the boundary layer over time. In this particular case, the boundary layer basically has
Different Rayleigh number.
Oh, yeah, you're right. But anyway, the total buoyancy is different. But the difference isn't in the Rayleigh number itself. Dynamical characteristics aren't different because the Rayleigh numbers are different, but because the thermal boundary layer is completely different.
This was just in general.
Yeah.